On March 4th and 5th of this year, Jews around the world will celebrate what they've been celebrating for almost 2,500 years, and that is the Feast of Purim or Purim. That celebration is a celebration of how the nation of Israel and all the Jewish people across the world were actually saved from a decree issued by King Xerxes that all the Jews would be exterminated, and the salvation came through a woman, Esther. That's the book that we're going to be studying for the next 5 weeks, and you just got the background of that story. Now, welcome to Hill Country Bible Church. We're glad to have you today. And for those of you who are joining us at Steiner Ranch in Lakeline, PM, and for those of you who are joining us at our new campus, Brushy Creek, we're excited to welcome you today. The story of Esther is actually unique in many ways in the Bible. In the whole story, the name of God is never mentioned. There's no mention of the law, the sacrificial system, or even prayer offered in the book. In fact, the book of Esther is unique because there are no visions, there are no voices, there are no visible miracles, and you wonder if the characters in the story are actually even aware and whether they're really tuned into God at all. In fact, when the 50,000 were released from Babylon to head back to Israel to rebuild their land, following what the prophet told the Jews that were in captivity, you need to go back to Israel and rebuild the temple, rebuild your land, it appears that Mordecai, Esther, and that part of the family decided that they were going to follow the power and the money, and they went the opposite way. They went to the palace in Susa. So we don't even know whether these folks that we're going to read about in the story had God and doing the will of God as a priority or not. And in the midst of all that, you kind of ask the question, well, then why are we studying this book? Well, there are three reasons why this book is really important. It's profound in many ways. First of all, it's profound for Jewish people. This particular book describes what could have been the annihilation of the Jewish race and how Esther saved those people, and so their lineage carries on today. In addition to that, it's important for Christians because this took place in 480 B.C., before Jesus Christ was born. In other words, the threat against all of the Jews was a threat against the line of Jesus, which would have eliminated the Messiah, and Jesus would not have been born had that decree been carried out. It's also important for us personally because the story is a story that feels like life today. In fact, it feels like what most of us feel when we leave on Sunday morning and go back into our world, our workplace, our school, our neighborhoods, our experiences. The story is all about the things that people value. It's about power. It's about prestige. It's about royalty or applause of people. It's about sex. It's about money. It's about the things that it seems like most of the people in the world spend most of their waking hours thinking about. I don't know about you, but sometimes I look around me, I see no visions, no voices, no visible miracles, and it kind of feels like we're living in a godless world. And the question is the world in which we live, is it godless? Is God absent, like he seems to be in the story of Esther? Or is it a story that's actually being authored, written by God himself? Now, as we work our way through the book, you be the judge of that. And I'm going to challenge you to be the judge of that in your personal life. Is God actually present in the mundane, day-to-day experiences, even though much of it feels like God is not anywhere to be found? And how would we see him if we actually decided to look? What would that look like? So we start off the first chapter, and as we go through the first chapter, just want to let you know that this is all preamble. Esther doesn't appear in the first chapter, so you're not going to see her there, but it sets the stage for her to be there by opening with this incredibly large, looming question that the author wants us to ask. And that is the question, who's in charge of the world anyway? Like, who's actually in charge of the world? Who's in charge of your world? Maybe someone different than you think. Okay, grab a Bible, open to the book of Esther, Esther chapter 1, starting in verse 1. If you don't have a Bible, they're all around the room, or you can get online right here in the auditorium and you can pull up a Bible. And here's where it starts. It starts in verse 1. It says, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. Now the question again, who's in charge of the world? Here is Xerxes. Now let's take a look at the landmass that he personally controls from Kush all the way to India. Let's put the map up. As you look at the map, this was the majority of the populated world at that time that we're aware of from history. His empire spans all the way from the Indus River, which is modern-day Pakistan, used to be India, all the way to Kush. Kush is Egypt, the Sudan. It extends into Europe all the way over to Greece. And that will become important for Xerxes at some point in the story. So this piece of land belongs to him. All 127 provinces, the various peoples that inhabit that land, swear allegiance to Xerxes. It looks like he's in charge of the world, doesn't it? Looks like he is the king over a vast empire. In fact, in the prophecy that we saw earlier in our little video trailer there from Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, which was prophesied 50 years before any of this story took place, it said that there would be three more Persian kings after Cyrus, and the third king would be the richest and the most powerful. And we find out the third king is actually this king, Xerxes. Now, some of your Bibles translated Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew word or name that he's given. Xerxes is the Greek name. That's a historical name that everybody knows him by. He also has a Persian name, probably used it in the Persian courts, that I can't really pronounce, so I'm not even going to give you that. We're going to talk about him as Xerxes. Now, I want you to see a little bit of his history. So Xerxes comes to power in 486 BC, and watch what happens. It says, at that time the king reigned from his royal throne in the capital of Susa. There were four palaces, four cities of palaces in their empire. Susa was the highest, therefore it was the easiest one to survive the heat in that part of the world. He reigned from Susa, and in the third year of his reign, that would be 483 BC, the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media. The princes and the nobles of the provinces were present for a full 180 days. That's 6 months. He displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. So he pulls together a six-month experience where all of the nobles from each of the provinces were brought together to explore and look at his wealth and his power. Now, why is he doing this? Though it's not mentioned in the story, Herodotus, the historian, actually talks about this event, and he talks about what Xerxes was doing by pulling all these people together was preparing for war. In 482, he's going to go to war against the Greeks. Those of you who have watched the movies, The 300, have seen this played out in cinematographic interpretation. He's planning a war. His father, Darius I, had already tried to defeat the Greeks, was killed in battle, and now Xerxes is trying to rally the empire, so it takes 4 years to actually pull everybody together, and what he's trying to say to all these people is, I've got money beyond your wildest imagination. In other words, nobles, if you will bring each of the peoples that you rule over, and we put together the largest army ever formed on the face of the planet under my leadership, there will be gold for you. There will be prestige for you. There will be power for you. He is planning his military strategy for 6 months, bringing these people together. Now, once he's done with that, He throws a party, verse 5. And when these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. In other words, after all the dignitaries leave, he consolidates his own clan. He pulls a party together from the least, the street sweepers, the slaves, all the way to the greatest. And he's got enough room in his gardens and his palace to pull all these people in. And he throws a party beyond your wildest imagination. Look at what it says. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on the mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Now here's the part some of you will like. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. In other words, when you're the richest man on the planet, you expect to have plenty of wine at your party. It says, by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. In other words, if you like a cab, you get a cab. If you like a Chardonnay, you get a Chardonnay. If you like a Bordeaux, you get a Bordeaux. In other words, whatever kind of wine you want, you just tell the wine steward and he'll make sure that you have it available to you. This is one of those parties. Now, it's interesting because there's something practical that actually comes up in the party. For those of you guys who throw parties from time to time, you know what happens to people, right? They get a glass, and then they set it down, and they can't remember which glass they were drinking out of, right? And so what do? To make sure that everybody has the same glass, otherwise you're going to run out of glasses or spend your life washing after everybody leaves. Practical thing. Now, the text says that everyone had their own golden, individually hand-carved goblet, so you could remember that your glass was the one that had the three lions' heads on it. And they had a glass for everybody. In other words, they solved this problem. You know, the wine glasses with little tabs so you can remember what color until you had your third glass, and then you can't remember what color your little tab was. Well, we've actually, in the excavation of Susa, which much of what was excavated in the 1800s is now in the Louvre in Paris, we've got gold goblets like this and many others. Everybody had their own individual gold glass to drink out of. What a party. What a party. Everybody together experiencing the wealth of the king, having the best wine. Everybody has their own personal gold glass to drink out of. How could it get any better? Watch what happens. Man, this guy's really incredible. It says, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. So, like, while the men are having their fun time together, she throws one for the women because they got to have a party for the women too. Didn't mix so well. And look what it says, verse 10, on the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine. Anybody know what that means? Okay, when he's in high spirits, in other words, he's got his good drunk on. He's happy. Seventh day, last day of the party, got his good drunk on, and he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. The seventh day, the party's starting to wind down. It's going to be over soon. What's the last great thing that the greatest man on the planet with everything could actually do as the crowning moment in the party? Well, since he's married to the hottest babe in the whole empire, he thinks, let me bring out Vashti. So he sends the seven eunuchs who will carry her out on her throne and says, tell her to get her crown on and come on out here. I want everybody to see how good looking you are. This is the only moment that I can think of that kind of fits. Tom Brady wins his fourth Super Bowl, throws a party at his house. While everybody's having a good time, he says, and by the way, I'm the greatest football player that ever lived. I've got four Super Bowl rings. I've got money beyond my wildest imagination. Giselle, come out here. Check her out, boys. That's what's taking place here. This guy is to be envied among all people on the planet. The power, the money, he's even got the woman. Or does he? Watch what happens in verse 12. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. She said, no. Who says no to the king? Who says no to the king? His wife. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Here's what's so ironic. He's just spent the last 6 months and 7 days trying to rally the world to believe that there's nobody on the planet that has what he has. And he makes one request in front of all of these people, and his wife says no. Maybe the power structures of the world in which we live are not quite as powerful as they think they are, and we've been led to think they are as well. So this throws everything into a big conundrum. So what's the question now? We wrestle with the question, who's the most powerful man in the world? It appears that the question now is, can one person actually change the course of history? Can one person make a difference in the world in which we live? Watch what happens, because it gets very intense at this point. So, verse 13, since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king: Karshena, Sethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marsena, and Memucan. For those of you who have dyslexia like me, reading these things kind of terrified me, but I got through it, okay? And by the way, why do they put the names in there? Like, this is not written as a fable. This is written as history. And some of you are going to wiki the book of Esther, and you're going to read down the list of the wiki a little ways, and as you get in there a little bit, you're going to see a phrase that says, scholars question the authenticity of the book because some of the events in the book have not yet been uncovered. And what we would say to the scholars is one word: they have not been uncovered yet. Every day that a spade is turned over in the Middle East, the Bible is validated over and over again. What people 20 years ago claimed to reject the Bible because they didn't see the name Pontius Pilate, they didn't see the name David, we've got all of the evidence. Artifacts have been dug up to substantiate all of that today. Wouldn't it be sad to be a skeptic and a non-believer today because there's a piece of pottery waiting to be turned over that will demonstrate and prove exactly what took place here, and again, validate the Bible over and over and over and over and over again. So while some people are saying, I don't know if this story is true or not, after 2,500 years, Jewish people all around the world are going to continue to celebrate it because it was their liberation. Okay, so here we are. That was my aside. Let me come back to it. Where were we? Okay, I read all the names of those people. Seven nobles of Persian Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. In other words, nobody walked into the presence of the king unless you were really important. There were only seven of them that had the king's face. That's what the Hebrew literally translates here. These seven, he calls them into special session. While everybody's standing with their mouth wide open, aghast, she said, what? He pulls a special session of his key guys, and they're standing together, they're sitting together, and they begin to talk, to ask the question, what are we going to do about this? I know, it's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. And so, Verse 15, according to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She's not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong. Now watch this. This is wild. She's done wrong not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the people of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day the Persian and Median women of nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. How powerful is King Xerxes? When his wife says no, every male in the empire feels like the relationship in their marriage has just gone on the rocks. Because think about this. Guys, what if all the women in the world knew that they did not have to obey you? The world would come apart at the seams, wouldn't it? Now, I don't know about you ladies, but I can almost envision that if we got all the men in the room drunk and we all went back in the corner and we had this conversation, it would come out probably about like this. In the morning when everybody sobered up, they would go, yeah, yeah, my wife says no a lot to a lot of different things. So interesting. The empire is now in jeopardy in the minds of these wise men, though drunk, leaders, that this one no changes everything. Now, you may think to yourself, well, like, okay, yeah, we get it. He's kind of insulted and this kind of looks bad. But watch how far this thing goes. And this gives you some insight into the court of the powerful and what they fear. Look at the next verse. In verse 19, it says, therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media. Now, keep in mind, written in the law, which cannot be repealed. This is going to come up again. The law is binding once it's made. And is it possible to change the law? That Vashti is never to enter the presence of King Xerxes, and also to let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Keep that in mind, because this is going to open up the door for Esther. Now, I'm sure when they say better than she, the beauty part is implied. But what the issue is, somebody that will do the king's bidding when the king says without talking back, right? We'll see how this goes. Remember, the question is, can one person actually make a difference? Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout his vast realm, all women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. And what these guys fail to understand is there's a big difference between fearful conformity and loving respect. You can make a law or make a rule in your nation, in your workplace, in your family, and tell people, here is how you're going to think about me. But it never, ever works in the heart. Forced conformity never engenders that kind of respect and love. All it does is engender a deeper sense of hurt and pain and rebellion. That's why it's absolutely foolish when a man opens the Bible to Ephesians 5 and reads it and says, honey, this says that you're supposed to respect me and submit to me. That is a dumb man. That's really dumb. Because the passage is very clear. Husbands and wives are to submit to each other out of reverence for Christ. Now, how does that take its shape? For men, it means sacrificial lovers who are willing to die to secure the well-being of their wives. That's a pretty tall order. Men, you do that, you won't have to worry about the respect part. It will be there. On the flip side of that, it says to the women, women, you are supposed to respect and submit to your husbands out of reverence for Christ, not because he's got it all together. And so your response to him is out of your love for Jesus. In other words, Jesus is the one who gives us the power in relationship. And you know what? If men, if you focus on just loving like crazy, you got plenty to worry about. Don't worry about what she's doing. Women, if you just focus on respecting Jesus so much that you work well as a team with your husband, you won't have to worry about what he's doing because you'll have your hands full in your relationship with Jesus just responding correctly. And so the Christian way is not edict. It's actually engagement through relationships empowered by the divine spirit in Jesus Christ. But they're going to make a ruling, and they're serious about it. Watch what happens in verse 21. The king and all his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should rule over his own household. Now, a couple ironies in the text. The first one is this. Memucan is worried that the women are going to find out, so he sends a dispatch to every part of the empire. If the women find out what Vashti did, they're going to disrespect their husbands, so let's tell them all. The message ultimately is delivered by the husband. In fact, the Hebrew of verse 22 says that proclaiming in people's tongue, every man should be ruler over his house. Literally, you could translate that every man by his tongue will tell his wife, I'm your boss. What's intended to create harmony had to become the greatest discussion of discord that you could ever possibly imagine. Can you imagine what the ladies were saying in the marketplace after this? Yeah, right. My husband came home, told me the king said he could tell me what to do. And there's all kinds of irony in the story. The powerful people are not even close to understanding how life works. What's also interesting here is that phrase that came from the Pony Express at the U.S. Postal Services, you know, not rain or snow, nor dark of night and all that stuff, that actually came from the Persians because they had a system of Pony Express dispatch that literally had people on horses ready to ride. And this Bible describes this, they had a system in place to get the message out to everybody in the empire. So that sets the stage. Vashti's out. There's an open door. The most powerful man in the world has consolidated his kingdom. He's fixing to go to fight the Greeks. That's the stage set. And I don't want to give away the next chapter. So you're going to have to come back to find out what happens in the next chapter. But I do want to apply it to us today. So application. Like, how does this relate to me? Like, what do I do with this? Well, what I would say is that when you look at your world, if you feel like, as I look around at the experiences of my life, there's no voices, there's no visions, there's no visible miracles from God. Is God really present in my life? Here's my challenge. A lot of it depends on your point of view. And the way you develop the point of view that you need to have, two things. One is to look longer. The other is to look deeper. In other words, where you sit in your job, in your marriage, in your classroom, in your world, where you sit, a longer look at the future and a deeper look today. If you take a longer look, what you're going to find out is that human control, though powerful in nature, It has its limits. It has its limits. In fact, it is very limited. Here is Xerxes, the most powerful man on the planet, and yet his empire is shredded to pieces today. Here are the Jews that are going to be threatened to be killed, and yet today, 2,500 years later, we essentially have a Jewish state recognized in the world today. He was going to get devastated by the Greeks. He's not as powerful as you think. And many of us sit in positions where people over us feel like they're dominating and destroying our lives. I mean, just think back to the past. I went back and thought about the bullies in my life that in middle school and in high school, like I spent a lot of time thinking about how do I avoid these people because we had some real thugs in the town I grew up in. How do I avoid them? How do I stay away from them? How do I manage that? You know what? All of those guys, all of those bullies, today they're either in jail, they're dead, or they're on Facebook. In other words, some of them weren't as bad as I thought they were. And they're not as bad as they think they are. They're on Facebook. You know, today, those moments when I was so afraid of people more powerful than me, when you take a long look, you really ask the question, how much control over your life, your long-term values, does the board of directors of your company actually have to keep you up at night worrying about what's going to happen to you? God is the author of history, not the powers in your life. They come and go, and out of fear, like Xerxes, they'll make really dumb decisions that feel bad and affect you, but they ultimately have limited power. Secondly, look deeper. Don't just look longer, look deeper. In other words, look into the actual circumstances of what's taking place in your life today. And what you're going to find out is one person, though limited in power, though powerless in some cases, can actually have a profound impact. Can have a profound impact. Here's what's so bizarre to me. My guess is that Vashti never even thought through her no. Never even thought through her no. I mean, seventh day of the feast, she may have been thinking to herself, it's been really humid up here in Susa. My hair is not going to work very well with the crown. I'm going to say no. I feel a little bloated. He wants me to look my best. I'm going to say no. We have no idea why she actually said no, and she may not have had any idea why she actually said no. And yet what she did set in motion not only an edict that went out and a law that was made, but it also opened the door for a Jewish orphan to be able to be in a position to override unequivocal, unchangeable Persian law and save hundreds of thousands of people and an entire family from annihilation. There are circumstances that are taking place in your life today that if you stop just looking at the circumstances as this is not what I prefer, this is not what I want, but look at the circumstances and ask the question, God, do you have a response for me in these circumstances? You may find out by going deeper that you actually see the hand of God clearly on Monday morning in your personal experience. On the day that Jesus Christ was nailed to the cross, all of his followers looked at that as the worst possible day. Had they looked deeper, they would have seen that the actual physical suffering and death of Jesus was paying for their sins. And had they looked longer, just 3 days, they would have known that a glorious resurrection was about to take place. Will you look deeper? And will you look longer? If you do, I believe that the story of God will begin to emerge in your world as well. Let's bow our heads, begin a time of meditation. We're going to receive communion in just a moment. So let's bow our heads and prepare our hearts.